Hey folks, Micah here. We're about to get started, but before we do, I just want to remind you that you can always get show notes for this and every other episode at ChristianTransHumanistPodcast.com. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for email updates so we can let you know when new shows are released, when new things happen in the Christian transhumanist community, and most importantly, so that we can connect you with other people just like you exploring questions just like this. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the show. Well, I'm Micah Redding, and I'm here with Ron Cole Turner, the professor of theology and ethics at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, a founding member of the International Society for Science and Religion. He has served on the advisory board of the John Templeton Foundation and the MetaNexus Institute, and is the author of books such as Design and Destiny, Jewish and Christian Perspectives on Human Germline Modification, The End of Adam and Eve, Theology and the Science of Human Origins, and most pertinent to us, Transhumanism and Transcendence, Christian Hope in an Age of Technological Enhancement. So thanks, Ron, for joining me today.
Sure.
So obviously there's a lot to talk about here, but I'd like to start with maybe your personal story. I'm interested in what led you to become a professor of theology, and then what led you from being a professor of theology to wanting to focus on these kinds of questions that touch on transhumanism and so forth?
Yeah, that could be a long story, Marcus. we'll take the so I grew up in a stage. My dad was a pastor. Mm-hmm. It was pretty typical northern evangelical mission focused kind of congregation. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty heavily engaged. I learned to play the piano. I played for singing services and that kind of thing. So I grew up really in the heart of that evangelical experience. Strong emphasis in that church on missions, mm-hmm. strong emphasis on healing, mm-hmm. Praying to God for healing. Also strong emphasis on taking seriously the life of sanctification and growth in the Christian life, mm-hmm. not simply forgiveness from sins, but okay, so now what happens?
Yeah.
You know, focus on growth.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so off to college and off then eventually to seminary after college. And, I was literally unpacking boxes in my first pastorate after seminary. Guy stops in to pick me up and give me a ride to a meeting. Where we needed to talk about my ministerial standing. So, nice enough guy, but we're getting acquainted. He looks over and sees all the boxes. I think he's a little bit perplexed that I would have books. But at any rate, he says, so what was your favorite subject in seminary? This was the end of period. And I said, theology. And he said to me, theology? I never read much of that in seminary, and I haven't read anything since. Well, sometimes God calls people by negative experiences, mm-hmm. and God spoke to me in that moment and said, look, somebody's got to take theology seriously. Somebody who cares about the church, who wants to engage actual living communities, somebody's got to take theological reflection seriously. So I, after 3 years, learning the practice of ministry in that congregation, I went back to seminary, PhD program at the time, and on through. And I think what I discovered there was seminary PhD program in theology, a lot of Karl Barth, a lot of heavyweight big theologians, not much focus on the natural world. And I came out of there resolved, I wanted to focus on the doctrine of creation. Then I went off, first job really toward the end of the PhD program was to serve as a campus minister at a technological university. And I learned that the board had just voted, well, we want to become distinguished in biotechnology. I mean, this was years and years ago, and this stuff was all brand new. And I thought, what? Oh, that's kind of interesting. What is that? And so it suggested to me not only that people who cared about the church ministry needed to be engaged in theology, but the theology itself needed to be engaged in the real world, people like engineers and scientists. And so they said biotechnology, genetic engineering. I did a crash course of my own reading on that field and quickly became identified as one of the very few people in the church who cared about genetic engineering. So quite literally, within 6 months or so, I went from zero to my own denomination was saying, well, we want to convene a little study. Who can be involved? And literally, I ended up chairing that study because there was just like nobody else. Well, again, that was back in the early 80s. And so the fields of science have gone on and on and on since then, and particularly the technological fields, as you know very well, have just exploded since. So we don't talk much about genetic engineering anymore. We talk more about a whole range of technologies. And it finally hit me maybe 10 years ago. Okay, I need to narrow down. I need to broaden, but I also need to narrow down. So narrow down on the human and broaden to include all the technologies that modify humanity. Hmm. And that led me, of course, then to the transhumanist agenda, because they do the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
Focus on the human, but what's the whole range of technologies? But of course, then I wanted to focus on it from a theological point of view. Mm-hmm. One more interesting little tidbit on this is, so I'm reading on all of that. I'm trying to think that through, make sense of it theologically, and it becomes clear to me that if it's true that transhumanism involves the possibility that there will be some form of humanity beyond us, beyond Homo sapiens, some form of humanity modified to the point that it really could be considered a different species, in other words, transhuman or post-human, wouldn't it make sense to kind of study the biology a little bit? How did we get here? What are the other forms of humanity that lead up to us? So that's what I was I've been working on maybe the last 3 or 4 years. That finally resulted in a publication that came out about 6-7 months ago, The End of Adam and Eve. Yeah. Story of Human Origins, but it's a really strong theological response to it, arguing basically that, for me at least, it only makes sense put together with a strong theological core of based in the classic Christian doctrine that in the incarnation, God takes up our humanity and makes it one in Jesus Christ. So that's the gist of that. Mm-hmm. Since that came out about 6 or 7 months ago, well, one of the nice perks of being a professor is that from time to time you get a sabbatical. So right now I'm on sabbatical, you know, nice. Very casual. So and the sabbatical is focused on really the transhumanist question, back to the technologies of human enhancement. But what I'm trying to do again is not just study the technology, not just study the bioethics debate, not just study the transhumanists, but offer what I hope is a deeply honest, rich, authentic Christian response. Mm-hmm. Basically, the gist of that is, okay, here's what the technology offers, here's what the transhumanists offers. Okay, Christians, what do you offer? Mm-hmm. And that takes you right to the core of the meaning of salvation in Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. What is that gift of salvation? How does it transform us? How does it change us from what we are to what we shall be?
Yeah.
And what I'm finding is that Christian theology has not been terribly good at expounding on that. Mm-hmm. Or it's limited to things like, we're guilty, we need to be set free from the burden of guilt. That's the doctrine of justification.
Right.
Important doctrine. Or some will say, well, justification and sanctification. That's where I grew up, strong emphasis on sanctification. But even there, it's somewhat limited to living a better life or kind of growing in sort of moral virtue. Mm-hmm. Really, is that all that God offers us? And the more you study the New Testament, And the more you study some of the richer sources of Christian theology from Eastern Church, the Eastern Orthodox theologians over the centuries, the more you see that there's a whole lot more that is offered to us. The Greeks use the word theosis, which means to be made in some very significant way godlike. Mm-hmm. Okay. I didn't grow up with that word.
Right.
That'd be a little bit too daring.
Right.
What I'm trying to do is recover the meaning of theosis as a doctrine of salvation, understood as transformation with a full realization of what it is that God intends for us now and in eternity in Jesus Christ. And what I find there is that the sky is the limit, and it goes far beyond anything that the transhumanists can offer, right?
Yeah.
So on the one hand, it goes, Christian transhumanism is, I think, the real, the authentic, the heavy duty, the robust, the strongest possible transhumanism.
Yeah.
Secular transhumanism, bless their heart, I think they're on the right track with a lot of things. And they do call our attention to the technology, but well, really two complaints. They don't go far enough, and they don't ask enough.
Mm-hmm.
The pathway to Christian transhumanism is kind of getting rid of the ego, getting rid of the pride, getting rid of the self-centeredness.
Yeah.
Following Jesus Christ, not just in a resurrection like his, as Paul puts it, but first of all, in a death like his.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a self-emptying. He emptied himself. We're called to empty ourselves likewise, so that as he is glorified, so we may be with him in that glorification. So secular transhumanists don't expect enough, but they don't ask enough either.
Yeah.
What I think they do is they say, oh, you know, you're pretty cool. Let's just make more of you,
yeah.
Right? You've got a long, healthy life. Let's just add a few years. Your brain is working pretty well. Let's just make it a little bit more, ramp up the processing speed or something like that.
Yeah.
Whereas Christian transhumanism, again, is, I think, the much more rigorous, rich, robust, and profound transhumanism, because it costs everything, but it gives you so much more.
That's interesting. If I'm hearing you right, you're saying that Christians and transhumanists and secular transhumanists both have this aspiration to, let's just say, infinity. But Christians say what we are now doesn't scale. And so we have to go through a process of giving up certain aspects of ourselves in order to scale to infinity.
Yeah. I mean, not everything about me needs to be enhanced.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, in fact, the Christian claim is that the clinging to the self is the problem.
Mm.
And when I let that go, when I, again, back to the biblical language, take up a cross daily.
Mm-hmm.
But when I let that go, a couple of things happen. One is I become really bold.
Mm.
I don't worry about dying.
Mm-hmm.
I can stand with people who are vulnerable in the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, I mean, to the extent that I'm deep down a coward, so I don't do this daily. But to the extent that I do it, I don't worry about dying. And the great, the models, I mean, the Desmond Tutus of the world have come to exactly that kind of an understanding. It's not about me. I let go of me. So that comes. But if God really intends to change us, and we're saying, oh no, I like me the way I am. Just give me more of me, right? One can almost hear the name Max Moore there in the background. maximize more of me. He's an interesting guy, and he's fun to engage.
Yeah, no.
But I think there's something about the secular transhumanists that can't escape the logic of their own position, and that is, I am not only good as God's creature, as God's project, I am good in all respects, and anything that makes more of me is a good thing.
Right.
Whereas a Christian transhumanist would say, I am God's creature, and good as all of God's creatures are, this move toward renunciation is not a move toward repudiation of the goodness of creation. We got to avoid that tendency in Christianity.
Yeah, because that's been a thing in popular Christian theology for a long time, right?
Right.
But I hear what you're saying, that we need both this basis of self-critique and the ability to locate ourselves in a larger picture, right? Not just be kind of singular points of ego, but that we actually... we exist in relationship. I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of ultimately what comes down to what does make a thriving society and a thriving future and so forth. And so it's not the proper thing to critique from any kind of perspective is not the aspiration to greater life. It's right. It's how we go about it, or the things that we're willing or not willing to do, I guess, in that process, how we conceptualize what that's actually going to look like as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of interesting things there. Going back to kind of where you started, what I find interesting is that, you've kind of got a foot in the practical world, and then a foot in this kind of theological world, and both in kind of ministry and then in your studies, and then in saying, okay, well, we need to engage this because this is what people are doing, like engineers and so forth. This is a real thing that's happening, and I always appreciate when people approach things from a very broad perspective like that, right? And that's kind of, like you pointed out, that's what a lot of transhumanism is doing, is saying, let's look at the whole kind of span of things that apply to human life. And it's so easy in our kind of world to just kind of get into a very specialized, field of study and never think about how theology impacts, normal people and, things like that. And the other thing that you brought out, which is interesting, is the comparison between having to grapple with the question of human origins and what that says about the human species and what it means to be human, and then having to grapple with transhumanism, our kind of future, and what that says about what it means to be human and the human species. So do you see the answers to those questions the same? And what's kind of your first step in framing that theologically? I mean, I think a lot of people still don't have a good idea of how to think about human origins within a theological and scientifically authentic framework.
Right. That's sort of an optional set of questions. I mean, somebody can be a transhumanist or Christian transhumanist. Right. Human origins. Well, I want to suggest that I think our thinking would be more complete and more rigorous if we were able to take that on board and give it serious attention. At least that makes sense for me. So, excuse me. We're in an absolutely fascinating time, not just in terms of technology, as you well know, but in terms of discoveries in the past. I mean, just today in the issue of the journal Science, more insight on human ancestry in China, a period of just over 100,000 years ago. But we're beginning to get little glimpses into that period of time. The story of our origins is absolutely fascinating, riveting, and so incomplete at this point that all we have are these tantalizing clues which suggest a new picture. Yes, we are an evolved species, 7+ billion of us, all one species, evolved, but we have evolved by a very complicated route that full of divergences. One community branching off, some people going here, well, are they people with they are Neanderthals or given some other biological label? Good question. But some people going here, some people going there, living independently for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, undergoing evolution independently, then coming together, converging, interbreeding, gene flow from one population to another. And here we are with all of our diversity of humanity as we see it today come into existence by this complicated process. On the one hand, I want to be very, very strong in objecting to any racist or elitist interpretations that people might put on top of that new science. Yeah. The scientists themselves are not doing it, but you know the world in which we live. People will look at that and say, "Oh, well, that's why certain branches of humanity are the way they are."
Yeah.
So I want to resist that. But more than that, I want to make the incredible claim that Jesus Christ. I mean, it's based on Galatians 3:28, for instance. In Christ, there are no more ethnic barriers. The ethnic distinctions remain, and what is distinct is valuable in its own varieties, but distinctions don't amount to barriers because in Christ all are one. I want to lay hold of that as the kind of the interpretive lens with which I look back over this incredible history of all of these forms of humanity that have come together to produce us, and argue that that's one. But then I want to flip that argument, and this is the new project that I'm working on now. I want to flip that argument and say, whatever we make of ourselves in the future, we cannot escape God's plan for the creation and for the role of humanity in transcending itself, going beyond its own self, using technology to modify itself. I mean, whether it's a smart thing to do, a wise thing to do, or not, suspend that question for a moment. If we engineer forms of humanity that are so significantly different, will we have engineered something that is outside the scope of the incarnation? And if that's the question, I want to argue, no, you cannot escape the majesty, the all-embracing majesty of the greatness of God, the Creator, who is with humanity. Now, here you have to think of humanity, not just as Homo sapiens, but all we have been and all we shall be. All of that is built into the creation by God the Creator as a way of drawing the creation back to God. So God meets us in Christ, but God draws us through this long evolutionary process up to the present, but not limited by what we are now. Long evolutionary process that could very well continue into the future, now especially fueled by technology, could very well continue into the future. The whole thing is God's plan. Yeah. The whole thing is within the scope of God's grace. The whole thing is within the encompassing and unifying grasp of the incarnation. As I say to my students here, I want my Jesus to be doing a lot of work theologically, and I really mean that. The incarnation is this breathtaking doctrine that what we are now in our humanity, with all of its ancestry, with all of its permutations that may lie ahead, that whole thing is caught up and made one and put on a pathway toward unification with God the Creator through Jesus Christ. Each of us individually, there's an individual destiny for each one of us, but more important than that is the whole thing collectively leads to something.
Yeah.
Now, there aren't very many theologians who have tested out these ideas. In fact, the two that come to mind are both mid-20th century Catholic Jesuit theologians. Yeah. One, of course, is pretty familiar to Christian transhumanists, and that, of course, is Teilhard de Chardin. The other is Karl Rahner. Rahner, a little more careful in how he puts things, a little less of a practicing scientist himself, but absolutely on top of these developments and able to reflect on them theologically with great sophistication. Were not for those two, I would feel very, very lonely working on the ideas that I just suggested.
Yeah.
How dare you take the doctrine of incarnation and expand it to mean all that has come before and all that will come after. Well, I have witnesses here.
Yeah.
Right. And again, it's Teilhard and Rahner.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. I think there's, you know, I always come back to the Romans 8 passage where it says all creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed.
Right.
And in hopes that creation itself will be liberated to participate in the joy and the freedom of the children of God.
Right.
And that whole thing, you know, and it's almost like, you know, most of the New Testament is so busy, they don't get around to like kind of looking at the edges. But Paul's like, oh, and by the way, this is where it's going.
Right. Exactly.
This is what the whole thing is about. Yeah. You know, I can't help making a connection that'll be kind of weird, but I've recently interviewed physicist David Deutsch, who's the kind of one of the creators of quantum computing, and he has he's very much about the ultimate potential of scientific knowledge and technology and so forth. But what's interesting is that he says. He talks about something called human universality. And what he's saying is that from whatever was the very first human to whatever there will be in the future, that we are all essentially doing the same thing. Some of us may be doing it faster. Some of us may be doing it, you know, slower, have less memory to work with or some, you know, like different kind of physical constraints. But there is no fundamental difference across the entire range. And so to focus on, just as you're saying, to focus on, this particular kind of subspecies of Homo sapiens, you know, was like this, and this other one was like this. He's saying ultimately those divisions don't hold up in an ultimate way. And I find that so interesting how that coincides with that kind of theological vision that you're portraying. And obviously that's kind of I'm taking a huge wide leap across disciplines, but that's kind of what we do here. I find that very very interesting, very compelling. I would be inclined to connect those things and read that in the same way that whatever we become. Like whatever AI is produced or whatever, you know, like there's no kind of ultimate creative being that is going to be outside of relationship with us or outside of a relationship with God, right?
Right.
And that's different than a lot of the assumption that's usually brought to this kind of conversation.
Right.
But that is the remarkable thing that the incarnation is kind of claiming.
Exactly. Yeah, it is very interesting. I found with the book on human origins, the Adam and Eve, end of Adam and Eve book, I became even more committed to a traditional doctrine of incarnation as I worked through the logic of that. And likewise, the more I'm working this present project, I'm becoming even more committed as I discover and stretch and elicit the resources of the Christian tradition and understanding the richer meaning of salvation as transformation. I become even more committed to that as a valid, intelligent, truthful, comprehensive way of being in this world, right? To me it makes the most sense of our past, but also our future, to see the world that way. But another thing you just said that I like very much is the reference to the rest of creation. It's not just humanity, as if humanity is some sort of standalone case. We do stand out because of what's going on inside this little 3-pound thing we call the brain. Nowhere in the universe, for all we know, is matter capable of such intelligence. But it's the whole universe and awakening to intelligence that becomes really the most important thing. Teilhard has a lot to say about that, of course. I've read some of the passages in Ray Kurzweil that lead in that direction. What I find really, really interesting is when you find passages in the theologians of the Christian East, the Orthodox theologians. Yeah. I'm thinking of Dimitris Stanilowa. I end my Adam and Eve book with an extended quotation from Dimitris Stanilowa, Romanian theologian, lived right through all of the Ceausescu idiocy of the 20th century. I mean, inside prison for a while because of his Christian beliefs. It's staggering the vision that some of these theologians have of the transformation of the cosmos. And humanity is part of that transformation, he says. It won't happen without us, but it is really God's transformation. It's God's plan from the beginning. It's not yet fully realized. It will be realized. And how do you describe it? Well, he and others resort to metaphors like light. The whole universe becomes luminous, as it were. He doesn't use the word intelligent, but he might. I mean, where people like Kurzweil might. But I think they're talking about very similar things. So if you jump to the quantum computing and the physics, I think that's exactly where Christianity needs to go in understanding the cosmic dimension of transhumanism. Christian transhumanism applied to the cosmos is just as stunning as Christian transhumanism applied to the individual. I mean, it really is an effort to read the whole thing as the whole of creation as a project underway, as you find in Ephesians, for instance. God's plan to unite all things in Christ. Well, it's not God's plan to unite what we have once called dead matter or brute matter. That's not God's plan to unite all of that, but rather to liberate it, to set it free, as in Romans 8, which you just quoted, liberate it, set it free, make it participants with all humanity in the freedom of the children of God. And so what does that look like? Luminescence, intelligence, saturating the universe, as Teilhard suggests in some of his imagery. Well, I tend not to work directly on all of that, but I find the passages that I am coming across to be absolutely stunning in their sense of wonder and awe and gratitude and joy in seeing the universe as on its way toward that transformation. And here am I, in my little way, on my way to my own transformation.
Yeah, Yeah, that's incredible. You've mentioned the Eastern Orthodox kind of influence and perspective. So I've kind of tiptoe into those waters, like I find that incredibly compelling as well. And you know, the resources that are there. What do you think it is about Eastern Orthodoxy or the thought that emerged within that kind of stream of Christianity that is so pertinent to these kinds of questions? Why is that different, or what are they bringing to the table that we maybe in the West haven't had access to?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and I don't want to be too negative about our own Western Christianity, but just to be clear with everybody, by Western Christianity we mean Christianity that grew up in the Latin-speaking world, centered, of course, in Rome. But Spain, France, the entire modern West, so Catholic and Protestant, whereas Eastern Christianity basically grew up in a Greek-speaking world, and that alone makes for huge differences. But it's the Christianity that we see as the is carried on today in Orthodoxy. Various semi-autonomous Orthodox churches, Russia, Greeks, etc. Okay, so for lots of reasons, the Western Church became more and more focused on the drama of sin and how do we get rid of the guilt that attaches to sin. And particularly by the time you get to the Middle Ages, the figure of Anselm of Canterbury, late 11th century, kind of jumps out here. I mean, he writes a little book. Why does Jesus become human? Let me rephrase that. Cur Deus Homo is the title in Latin. Why does God, the second person of the Trinity, become human? Why does God become human? Why the incarnation?
Yeah.
Well, it's because we have offended God's honor. We have incurred a debt we can't repay. We need that debt repaid by a human of infinite value. Who could that be? Well, okay. So, but that's it. Mm-hmm. That's what the incarnation is all about, to pay a debt that we can't pay so that we can kind of get back on the right track with God. Well, there's some deep truth there. Have I offended God? I do that all the time. Do I need reconciliation? Of course. I looked to Jesus Christ for that reconciliation. Again, deep truth to that. But, in some of our Protestant churches, we kind of choreograph this into the service, into the liturgy. We have the confession of sin and the assurance of pardon. And every week, we confess we have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed. If you use the old prayer, usually it's updated and it's not nearly as serious, but still, we've managed to goof up again. And then the minister says, I declare to you that in Jesus Christ we are forgiven. I keep thinking that before I die, I'm going to generate enough nerve in a very big church, very formal setting, to stand up at that point and scream at the loud of my voice, loudest voice possible. So what? What next?
Yeah.
Free from the burden of guilt, just to go back to the same rut, and have to come back here next week, the or is typically unanswered in most expressions of Western Christianity. Not entirely. Wesley had a lot to say about it. Luther in his own way. There are resources in Western Christianity to tell you about the growth that God intends for us in the Christian life. Not just the growth, but the transformation.
Yeah.
I mean, being made anew, being born again. Right. I mean, I think evangelicals really are onto something when they single out that phrase.
Yeah.
What is it to be not just forgiven, but born again, made a new being or new creation, as you find in 2 Corinthians? To flesh that out, the Eastern Church has focused much more on that. I mean, they pointed out fairly simply that if the problem is guilt, maybe God could have come up with a less costly way than Jesus dying on the cross to get rid of guilt. I don't know, maybe, yeah. Probably. I mean, you know, give God a certain credit for imagination here. The problem is not guilt. The problem is that we are mortal, that we will die, that unless our humanity is transformed, we cannot live eternally with God. Unless our humanity is being transformed even now, we can't share fully in the new community that God is creating. So the emphasis is on transformation, not on satisfaction,
yeah.
Right? Not on satisfaction of an offense, right? But on transformation. Well, so there are resources, and it's fascinating. It's not just me coming at this via my engagement with technology.
Right.
Theosis, this Greek term that kind of summarizes all of this, mm-hmm. it's suddenly become a hot topic in certain circles in theology. Mm-hmm. Mainstream Protestant theology, evangelical theology even more. Mm-hmm. Certainly the Wesleyans are very strongly involved in this, but people like Randy Maddox at Duke Divinity School, very good Wesleyan theologian, strong emphasis on recovering of these themes. Because of their engagement with technology and transhumanism? No.
Right.
They sense that there's an inadequacy in Western Christianity that they want to remedy. But I also see it in some of the new and independent churches that are arising, independent of the old denominations where you do the choreographed confession of sin. Emphasis on Christianity as a message, as an invitation to a life of uplift. Mm-hmm. Or you see names like Elevate or Elevation.
Yeah.
Churches across the country using terms like that. Or I look at some of the ads that some of the new emerging churches take, and they emphasize this message of Christ makes a positive difference in your life. Not just negates a negative thing, right? Not just satisfies the guilt, gives God satisfaction for the guilt.
Yeah.
Not just negates the negative thing, but much more positively, lifts you up into a new kind of existence that is joyful, that is life-affirming. And I think that makes sense in this particular environment in which all kinds of technologies are going to be coming at you, and it gives you some way of saying, do those new technologies fit, mm-hmm. or do they divert me from my core process of transformation as I am living into it with sisters and brothers in a Christian community focusing on the positive message of salvation through Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
That's my core transformation. Here are these other things. Do they fit with it? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Do they tempt me maybe to do some things that don't fit, maybe to go in directions that are maybe just too ego focused, mm-hmm. too self centered, buy this so you can get ahead kind of focus,
right?
or consume this technology of human enhancement so that you can be a more generous, more loving, more compassionate, more energetic human being in living out your calling.
Yeah.
What I want to suggest is that you can't draw a line through the technologies and say, oh, well, wouldn't it be nice if certain technologies of human enhancement had warning labels?
Right.
All right. take this entirety of human enhancement, and it'll make you more selfish.
Right.
Take one, and it's likely to increase selfishness, mm-hmm. and you know, maybe insomnia, but with its yeah. with selfishness, so you can lie awake at night and think about. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if there were there are no warning labels, there are nothing attached to the technologies that are being developed that are coming along, that offer increases in human capacities or freedom from some of the limitations that that are a result of our biology. No warning labels. So Christians have got to have the maturity of their own awareness mm-hmm. of what it is to be committed to a life of realizing their salvation as transformation here and now, in anticipation of life eternal, but here and now, living that out, and suddenly these technologies come along. Do they fit? Do they not fit? You know, I don't think any government, any bioethics panel, any expert, much less any theologian, is going to be able to say, oh, you can use this one, but don't use right. that one. I think it's going to be up to each Christian to think through very carefully, how does this fit my calling? My deep lifelong project of opening myself up to the fullest possible realization of the gift of salvation as transformation offered to me by the grace of God who created me and who wants to make more of me. No, not make more of me in the sense of Max Moore, but make me, well, back to an interesting phrase that we quote from one of the early theologians, but we get the quote wrong. But I like it the wrong way. Everybody likes it the wrong way. the ancient theologian is Irenaeus of Lyon, right. who around the year 200 said, "The glory of God is a human being fully alive." Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is he didn't quite say fully alive. The glory of God, a more accurate translation is, the glory of God is the living human being, the living human. What a positive insight, and it almost compels us to add, fully alive. what a positive insight. God's glory in the end, the glory of God the Creator who set all this thing up and leading to an end, that glory is, dare we say, enhanced? Mm-hmm. God's glory is enhanced when you are enhanced, mm-hmm. when you are made alive, when you are made fully alive. Mm-hmm. Now, in fairness, Irenaeus is not particularly talking about technology,
sure.
but he's talking about practical things. Yeah. He doesn't mean alive spiritually, but also not alive in other very practical ways, yeah. like properly nourished. And Lyon, France, I think he probably meant with a good glass of wine from time to time. But we'll leave that for others to debate. I think he means alive in every dimension, bodily, mentally, spiritually. So spend time in prayer, but spend time taking care of your health and nurturing every dimension of your humanity, because that's what God wants you to do, and God is glorified when you do it.
Yeah.
By the way, Irenaeus is sort of the patron saint. I mean, I mentioned Teilhard.
Yeah.
I mentioned Karl Rahner before any of them. You have to kind of catapult over people like Anselm and a few others. But all the way back to the late 2nd century,
yeah.
you have Irenaeus of Lyon, a stunning visionary of these ideas.
Yeah.
If someday we get to sit and talk with these folks, I certainly want to talk to Paul, yeah. but I really want to talk to Irenaeus of Lyon. I mean, the audacity of imagination at a time of incredible persecution.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people around him are being martyred, literally, as he writes this. How could he dare to dream such a grand vision except for the joy awakened in him by encountering the Gospels and the Apostle Paul and others who inspire within him this vision of the incomprehensible, the unimaginable goodness of God the Creator, who isn't stingy, who doesn't want to keep us in little boxes, but wants us to flourish in the richest possible sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that it almost seems as if that the people in the moments of kind of greatest persecution, that was their moment of greatest imagination. And it's on the, you know, the reverse side of it, it's when we Christians kind of have it easy that we seem to tend to really be suspect of that kind of Christian imagination. And so, you know, like you're talking about, in my religious tradition, we have the five steps of salvation. So this is the you know, five-step plan to salvation. And it literally ends when you're baptized. There is no vision of what happens next. And later on, people were like, oh, okay. And so they added a sixth, and it's live faithfully, which also is not an doesn't really tell you anything other than basically to not mess up. That's kind of the vision. And I think you're pointing out that that's not adequate to the kinds of questions that we face today. Right? It's not just enough to hold the line or to decide, is this new technology going to put me outside of the circle of grace or something? It's a question that we have to face at every point. Is this moving me in the direction of God's redemption and the mission that I'm trying to participate in, with the people of God and so forth? And that's a much bigger question that requires a much bigger story and a much bigger imagination.
Exactly.
And yeah, so I think you're right to identify I think a lot of people are coming up against some of the limits of how we've sometimes framed the Christian conversation.
Right.
And that's really intriguing, but I do think it's incredibly important. Now, one thing that you brought out in your book that I think is interesting is, there's the whole question of, okay, so should we just stop where we are and kind of reject any other enhancements, and you kind of made a comparison between this idea of, I think, therapy and enhancement, and then the Christian doctrine of, salvation and then glorification.
Right.
You kind of drawn a comparison there. Are there reasons within the Christian understanding to say, well, it's not sufficient just to kind of permanently rule out any kind of enhancement, but actually we need to look at these in a at least a potentially positive way?
Yeah, that's interesting. The text that you're referring to, I wrote that several years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
My thinking I hope it's moved along a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe not a whole lot, but I do remember thinking that it isn't interesting. Bioethics, they draw this distinction between therapy and enhancement. Mm-hmm. And basically, everybody's for therapy. You got a sick child, of course you treat. I mean, somebody's sick, of course you treat them, mm-hmm. right? No big moral problem with that question.
Yeah.
There are lots of moral questions about healthcare and funding and all that, but no question, somebody's sick, it's a good thing to treat them. Somebody's not sick, but you've got a medicine that treats sick people. What if you treat somebody who's not sick? Good example that comes to mind, of course, would be dementia. Mm. All right. And there have been a lot of people who said, oh, you've got a drug here that you think provides a little bit of help, maybe at least, in managing Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it works for them, I mean, I I don't have a disease, but I could use some help remembering things.
Yeah.
I forget where I put my keys. So if it helps them, will it help me? And so there's this off-label shift, and we suddenly get very cautious about that. There are good reasons to be cautious. Effectiveness, side effects, all kinds of things. Bioethicists try to draw this line, and then most of them will back up and say, but of course we realize a line can't be drawn. It's more like, you got some therapies, yeah, those are therapies. You got some enhancements, yeah, those are enhancements. There's some blurry stuff in the middle, and we don't know which side that's on. And on top of that, if you think that there's a line, like there's one room in which you're going to put all of the technologies of therapy, and another room in which you're going to put all the technologies of enhancement, if you think you can do that, draw that kind of line, and then say, therapy, good, enhancement, bad, stay away, block the door. If you think there's that kind of a line that can be drawn that makes sort of a moral decision for you,
right?
Give it up. You're not gonna get there.
Yeah.
Well, in wrestling with all that, I begin to think: does Christianity do something similar? Do we have two aspects of our idea of salvation? And simplistically, you could say we have justification and sanctification. Justification is getting rid of the problem. Mm-hmm. It's analogous to therapy. Mm-hmm. Sanctification is going beyond normal human healthiness to something more, what, spiritual, more holy, more compassionate, more available to God's leading. And I began to play with that, and I began to puzzle over, why do so many churches talk about justification but don't have anything practical to say about sanctification? I mean, I've joked with my students. I'm teaching at a Presbyterian seminary. I've joked with my students and said things like, look, automatic A for the course if you can go find a Presbyterian church where on a Sunday morning you hear the word sanctification. Right, and it's sad because it's in John Calvin all over the place. I mean, he's our main man. Mm-hmm. It's in Calvin. It just is not in the church today. So I began to wonder, could there be some sort of seismic deep subterranean here?
Yeah.
Bioethicists, therapy is good, enhancement's bad. Many Christians. Justification, okay, we know it. Well, that's good. We need that. Sanctification, we're not sure.
Yeah.
We're just not sure where that's going. I think that's clearly overly simplistic, but I suspect there is some sort of deep resonance of connection between them. Obviously, what I want to do on the theology side is move way beyond mere justification only to a much richer account of salvation as preeminently sanctification, or the word I like better is transformation. Doesn't have a whole lot of biblical basis, but be not conformed to the world, but be transformed.
Yeah.
And increasingly, I'm finding biblical scholars who say that's the word. Transformation is a key word in describing a biblical New Testament view of salvation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finding that again and again in the people that I read. So, just as I hope that the secular bioethicists can kind of sort through this and say, you can't condemn something because it's an enhancement.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to ask a lot of other questions about it. So, Christians will warm up to and embrace a rich and complex and multi-dimensional notion of sanctification, which, kind of like back to Irenaeus, had to do with being just being alive in the richest possible theological sense of that. And that has to do with the health of the body, a healthy relationship with the environment, eating healthy things and avoiding unhealthy things, there's no dimension that doesn't pertain to being alive. But what is it to be alive, or as we like to say, Irenaeus said, being fully alive in Christ? And so that does not mean that everything out there that other people say is good for me as a Christian.
Right.
Right? So being alive means more work in thinking about, okay, so what am I going to tap to as consistent with this, and what am I going to say no to?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we run into this problem every day, I think, with social media and the smartphones that we carry and all of that. Being alive, being connected, okay, good. Being frozen to the screen and bumping into people when we walk along, or I mean we all see people texting and driving, or of course we have a new poster child for this. Better to tweet and get your job wrong at the Oscars than to keep your job at, you know, I mean, how addictive this technology. And so. And I'm using the word addiction rather loosely, but how addictive the technology. Even a particular technology like a smartphone enabled for social media, even a very narrow piece of technology, you got to make... You've got to make deeply theological judgments about... I mean... God help you if you drive while texting. I mean, I'm talking about something much deeper than that. To what extent does it enhance my being alive as God intends me to be alive?
Right.
Does it make me more aware of you so that I can pray more knowledgeably about you?
Mm-hmm.
Or does it divert me from my prayers?
Yeah.
And that's almost a moment by moment. Very, very personalized process of discernment. Done, I think, best in communities where people are talking about these things.
Yeah.
I don't know how many of our churches really do spend time inviting people to talk and reflect about this. Yeah, usually if there's a sermon illustration, it's one that goes badly. I mean, the punchline is anti-technology.
Right.
That's not helpful.
Right.
I mean, for me to be aware of the plight of Syrians in Aleppo in real time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, on the one hand, it breaks my heart.
Yeah.
But breaks it in a way that a Christian's heart should be broken.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm not going to say no to these technologies.
Right. Yeah. I'm reminded, I was part of the Wonder and Fear of Technology conference at Redeemer Presbyterian in New York.
Okay.
This past winter. And David Kim wanted to really, who's one of the ministers there of Faith and Work, he wanted to really put a different set of tools for people to kind of think about their interaction with technology. And so he led several different prayer sessions where he had us take out our social media apps and pray through them. And do this with, you know, with our phones and the, you know, and so to move us from this kind of perspective where we kind of hate read a bunch of stuff, you know, like, and look for reasons to get upset or just amused or something, to this, to using it actually as a tool for which, you know, we're bringing kind of a Christian perspective with us into it. And so he, you know, he's not saying this is not a difficult thing to navigate, but he's saying, like, we can't just not navigate it. We can't just write off God's presence in that. We have to actually bring the Christian presence into all of this.
And to add to that challenge, the technology keeps changing.
Yep.
Smartphones seem to have hit a plateau now for a decade or so, but we know that they will be obsolete. And what will they be replaced? I don't know. If I do, I'd be very rich.
Right.
But we know they'll be replaced with something more advanced and with greater capabilities and greater urgency of discernment.
Yeah.
So it is a skill that needs to be cultivated in Christian communities so that it works in real time, because we never get it done, right? It's never, oh, smartphones figured out, that's it.
Yeah.
There's always something new coming.
Yeah, definitely. Before we go, I wanted to bring up something that's really interesting to me. You've done, as you've kind of explored these questions around transhumanism, you've done some research into the origin of transhumanist thinking, and even the word transhumanism. And most people kind of trace this back to the 50s, but you trace things back considerably farther. Yeah. So can you talk briefly about where you see that coming from?
Well, the origin of the word, the best anybody knows, comes from Dante, Paradiso, which is the third part of Divine Comedy, first canto of Paradiso, Italian, trasuminar, significar, per verbo, non si poria. Translates roughly. These are infinitives, verbal infinitives in Italian. Trasuminar is to go beyond the human, right? So you know, to have a literal translation, to go beyond the human, to signify that or say that in words, it's not possible. Which is a great line, you know, for a poet. To say what it means to go beyond the human, that's not possible. Wow, what a line, because he's exactly right. What is it to go beyond the present? Can you say what that is? No, you can't say what it is, except it's not the present, right? Mm-hmm. That's all you can say. So I think he's absolutely right. Well, the best treatment of this question, as you posed it, is by two historians of science, Peter Harrison, and I think it's Joseph Woliniak. I believe I've got it right. Okay. I think if listeners have any trouble finding that, I'm pretty sure blogged about it, or I can send you a reference to their short article. They trace it, of course, to Dante, but then they trace it through various translations of Dante. And this is where it gets, this is the pathway by which Dante's Italian poetry actually gets cashed out. Mm-hmm. Somebody translates it as transhuman, and then it evolves slowly into transhumanism. Mm-hmm. They insist that there's a Canadian writing at around 1940 who is the first to turn it, I believe, into transhumanism. It's not Julian Huxley. Julian Huxley is writing in 1957, I believe is the right date on that, writing in 1957. And he puts it forward kind of as a manifesto, as a creed, to use technology for humanity to transcend itself while remaining human. He says, I believe in that. We need a name for it. Transhumanism is so he puts it forward as a kind of a manifesto. But whether Huxley actually read this Canadian, Harrison and Woliniak say they can't find the evidence that he did, but who knows whether he did or not. But at any rate, it was almost an inevitable word given the popularity of the translations of Dante. What I think is very interesting, though, is that in Dante, I mean, Dante coins the word, okay. Dante does not create the idea. And to me, this was kind of the first step in changing my own thinking about transhumanism. Dante does not create the idea. It is given to him through the rich history of Christianity, only, 1,300 years old at that point. Yeah. But it's given to him through that rich history of Christian thought that leads up to the time of the Italian Renaissance. Dante... he's talking about many of the very, let me rephrase that, the idea that underlies Dante's word embraces many of the ideas that we've been talking about over this entire conversation. Yeah. Salvation as transformation here and now and in eternity as one ongoing process. Salvation as transformative. For Dante, that's very clear. In fact, it's kind of interesting. Who is Dante's guide in paradise? It's Beatrice, until he gets to the very end, and at the very end, it becomes Bernard of Clairvaux, a monk, a mystic, one who, in Dante's time, sort of personified going beyond the human, and just in his graces, his gifts, his spiritual insight and all of that. So who is the guide to becoming transhuman in the Christian sense? It's this figure that kind of personifies all of the history of Christianity, all of the great theologians of the ancient East, all the way back to Irenaeus, that whole updot that lays claim to a phrase that is originally in Irenaeus, but it's then picked up by really every theologian of the ancient Eastern Church. God becomes human so that we might become divine. Or God in Christ becomes what we are so that we might become what he is. God becomes human so that we might become divine. That simple phrase, that's theosis, that's transformation, it just takes the lid off of all of our imagined limitations for how we might be changed. It's not just the limits of our biology, it's the limits of our spirituality and of our Christian vision. And God really wants us to be, insofar as possible for creatures, to be as much like God as possible, to share in the light, the glory, the vibrancy of eternal life, right? I mean, the joy of, and as Gregory of Nyssa, I mean, the more you read the Eastern guys, the more you find yourself wanting to quote them. It's not just when we've been there 10,000 years, right? You know, we've no less days.
Yeah.
Now, for Nyssa, the problem was we'll get bored after 10,000 years or 100,000 years, where we have kind of capped out on contemplating God. No, he says, because the exploration of the incomprehensible and infinite mystery of divine love, divine grace, is... It's fully realized at each stage, but at each stage you realize you have only begun. And there are always, because of the sheer infinity of God, right? There's no limit. Because of the sheer infinity of God, there is no limit to exploring the vastness of the wonder and grace and goodness of the Creator. And the more I think about all of these things, and the more I am challenged by the moment in which we live, I'm so grateful for people like you raising the possibility of putting all of this together in a coherent program and having the audacity to call it Christian transhumanism. I mean, I think you're laying claim to all of that tradition. not just Irenaeus, but the Apostle Paul, through Irenaeus, through people like Nyssa, through people like Dante and Bernard Clairvaux, but on through to the present theologians like Bayard and Karl Rahner, who had the audacity just to take off the narrow limits and ask the broadest possible questions. Who is God? What is God up to with this thing we call creation? Why is it so so puzzling, so enigmatic, so frustrating, and yet so joyously creative at the same time? Yeah. And what is it to live in that with the fullest possible awareness and openness to being to contributing it to its transformation by being profoundly open to being transformed within.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I love it. I love that you're coming at this with such a broad perspective, because I think that's exactly what we need and what we're so often lacking. You know, we have specialties, we have in American Christianity, we have this like sense that you know, we've lost all sense of history, like there, you know, like, and we have to recover that big picture. Yeah, because I mean, that's the whole idea of being followers of God. God is the big picture, right? Like God,
absolutely.
God is the biggest picture there can be.
Exactly.
Yeah. So,
and the more you get into that, the more you take off the limits for our own humanity, mm-hmm. right? I mean, back to that phrase of Irenaeus, the more you contemplate and open yourself to the glory of God, the more you become alive.
Yeah.
It's not like God's glory means I go down in value right. or worth or completeness or being fully alive.
Right.
It's great.
Yeah, yeah. The more glory there is to God, the more that we experience life, and I guess vice versa.
Right, exactly.
Well, that's fantastic. We've talked about your book, Transhumanism and Transcendence. I believe you've got new material coming out sometime in the near future. So where will people be able to look for that, or where should they try to follow you? To kind of best keep up with what you're working on.
Okay, so the book on human origins is called The End of Adam and Eve, mm-hmm. Theology and the Science of Human Origins, available on Amazon, and I self-published it, so you can get a print copy for $5.99
wow.
or a digital copy for 99 cents,
wow.
Even free on some sites.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do the same thing with the next book. Mm-hmm. In a way, it's a sequel, like Adam and Eve, where did we come from? I don't have a good title yet for the next book, but where are we going? Mm-hmm. Is the gist of the question. Maybe Transcended Humanity, I'm not quite sure for the title. But I'm hoping that comes out sometime next fall. Likewise, a print-on-demand, self-published, $5.99, I'm hoping, kind of publication. Available. In the meantime, Facebook, Twitter, Ron Cole Turner on Twitter, mm-hmm. And I blog at Theology Plus. Mm-hmm. You have to write that out, theologyplus.org. Mm-hmm. And that has links to, you know, to books and things like that. So,
Okay. Yeah, I'll put links to all that in the show notes. Definitely. Check out the books and the blog. I keep up with that. So there's some good explorations there. So and we'll definitely be looking forward to your next work, because I think it's going to be fantastic. So, but thanks so much for joining me and having this conversation, and thanks for pursuing this conversation, because it's so important. And like you said, you know, in a lot of ways, This feels like a very lonely conversation.
It is, but thanks to you, it's not near so lonely. And Mike, I felt all along, even though we don't know each other very well and have only spent a few days in each other's company, you're very much a kindred spirit. I've got the advantage of an academic life and the leisure that it offers, particularly with a sabbatical. So I can sit here and pick stuff up in libraries. Out there, meanwhile, very active technical career, but also this kind of ministry that you've taken on of organization, along with Chris Beck and some others.
Yeah.
And I see us very much in a kind of tandem or a partnership that works. Just I can't help but think that the future we're both committed to requires all these levels of engagement, right? Yeah. It requires organizing, it requires research and publication, it just requires all of this, and what a joy when we can connect it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Absolutely. I so agree. And it's kind of like, you know, Paul's metaphor, the body of Christ, right? Everybody has different roles. So I'm super excited when, you know, other people kind of join in these kinds of efforts on their own, you know, with their own gifts and their own specialties and so forth. So very much appreciate what you're doing. And thanks so much. But we will be talking absolutely in the future. And so I look forward to that.
I look forward to it, Micah.
Yeah. See you later.
Take care.